Welcome to Breakthrough Success. I'm your host, Mark Roberti, the content marketing expert, bringing you 5 new episodes every week where I and top-level guests teach you how to take your business to the next level and achieve your breakthrough. Hello, Breakthrough Success listeners. I just wanted you all to know before the episode actually starts, I've been working a little bit behind the scenes to give you something really special. So a while ago, I wrote my book, Content Marketing Secrets, which helps people create, promote, and optimize their content for growth and revenue. And I just put the finishing touches together to offer that for free to anyone who is interested. So if you want your free copy of Content Marketing Secrets, all you have to do is head over to markgoberti.com/book. Now, let's jump right into the episode. Content marketing is such a powerful form of marketing where you create content, you spread it. But one of the things that people want to know about content marketing is, well, how do I profit from it? Where do I see the ROI? Where do I see my efforts paying off? And that's what we're going to focus on in this episode, getting that strong ROI and being able to see where it's happening. So we actually have a really great guest who's going to talk about that. He's actually an award-winning entrepreneur and a journalist who has helped expose gun traffickers and gender discrimination. He is also a board member of the Hatch Institute, a nonprofit for investigative journalism, and currently serves as the founder at large at Contently, a company that works with Fortune 500 brands and has helped over 100,000 freelance journalists, artists, and photographers put food on the table. His latest book, Dream Teams, unveils what separates groups that simply manage to get by from those that get better together, and how we can make our companies and communities better by understanding the difference. Today's guest for episode 216 of the Breakthrough Success Podcast is none other than Shane Snow. Shane, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for that awesome intro.
Shane, I'm really happy to have you on the show as well. And content marketing is just such a hot topic, especially when we're thinking about ROI. So this is a topic that I'm really looking forward to dive in. But I'm wondering, before we do that, if you give us some backstory about Contently, how that idea came around, and why it's important to you.
Yeah, so the company is now, it's a big old content marketing platform, right, that kind of has all the bells and whistles. But it started out as a way to, like you mentioned, I'm a journalist, and I wanted to help friends of mine who were freelance journalists get paid, basically. And there's a whole list of things that have nothing to do with your craft, if you're a creative storyteller, that you kind of have to do if you're a freelancer. So you got to find clients, you got to get them to pay you on time, you got to do your taxes as a entrepreneur, essentially. You have to market yourself. You have to know how to build a website so you can promote your work. And so what originally the company was is basically a place for freelance journalists to build a profile, make it really easy to build a website and promote their work. And then we would attract clients that we would then broker the work to the freelancers. So, you know, originally it was like CBS wants to hire a freelancer in Kansas or whatever. We know someone in Kansas, so we broker that work. But what we found is the companies with the most willingness to pay good rates for good creative work and the most interesting work actually more and more became companies, brands that were not media companies, but were getting into content marketing. So, you know, Pepsi wanted to hire a bunch of reporters to do stories about World Water Week and conservation stuff and for their blog and their social media. And American Express had this site about small business owners and sort of the plight of making it as a, you know, as a small shop in America. And they wanted business reporters to go interview these people and make videos and stuff. And that kind of work not only paid great, but it also actually allowed our creative freelancers the time and space to do really good quality work that they cared about. So that's how we got into content marketing. And then after that, we realized that, you know, if you're Pepsi, you don't just need, you know, 15 reporters and photographers to write about World Water Week. You actually need to know, you need to manage the project. So you need to manage it like a proper marketing channel. And you need to know how things perform and how they're paying off. And this gets into the ROI thing that you're talking about. So the company basically turned into this almost like a sales force for content marketing. You kind of manage everything. You manage all your people, and you can find people too. But then you manage the planning and the strategy and the creation and the dissemination and the tracking and the kind of feedback and optimization of content, whether it's for marketing or for, you know, sales enablement or anything like that. But that's it's part of this category of companies now called CMPs, content marketing platforms. That's basically the history of the company. And I had no idea this world existed when we started. I was just trying to help newspaper reporters, and here we are. And I'm very happy with the amount of work we've been able to do with some really neat people and some really neat companies.
And one of the things, like you mentioned, the Pepsi example, where they hired 15 journalists to help them with the Water Week, and like that's something where Pepsi is looking to make an investment in those journalists, and they want to get some return on that. So one of the things for content creators, and I think that example illustrates, is that it's not always easy to tell where the ROI is coming from, because who's to say that those journalists are the reason that Pepsi's sales go up? Maybe it's something else that happens. So how can we not only get a strong ROI with our content, but also be able to tell where whether this is a good ROI, because there's just so many variables to content marketing?
Yes. So we've built out a fairly sophisticated content strategy methodology that gets at that question, because it is tricky. And the first thing to keep in mind is to not conflate different kinds of marketing goals, which is really easy to do. But we basically, if you break down a marketing funnel, there's basically at the very top, there's just making awareness that, you know, a company exists. And then after that, there's kind of changing people's minds, you know, getting them to think in a certain way, shift their perception. After that, it's actually getting people to lean forward and to become, you know, a lead or a prospect or whatever it is. And then it's getting those people who are already kind of interested and are curious about what you're doing to become customers. And then after that, it's about helping your customers succeed and become advocates or stay as customers. And there's different metrics that you would measure for any of those things. And one thing that happens a lot is because the internet, you can kind of track a lot of things that you can't track offline, or, you know, with television or billboards or other kinds of marketing. We tend to try to track everything like a direct response ad, which is actually not really possible with some kinds of marketing goals. So if you're just trying to raise awareness, you know, Pepsi in that example, they're actually, everyone knows who Pepsi is. If you don't know who Pepsi is, that's, you know, kind of strange, actually. It might be, you know, certain international markets where people don't know Pepsi, but you know who Pepsi is. They, in that case, were trying to get people to understand that they cared about conservation. So that's a perception shift kind of thing. So how do you measure that? That's going to be like any kind of TV campaign where you're trying to shift people's perceptions about something, which means you're trying to measure how many people got exposed to this and take a sample of people's attitudes before and after being exposed to this, which is sort of like a survey-based thing, which is actually a lot more involved and a little more manual than a lot of kinds of content marketing tracking. There are tools. We built a little tool at one point that actually pops up a little survey while you're on a, you know, a blog post or a piece of content on a website, that asks, you know, questions about basically brand lift questions about the brand. And then you compare people who have never seen, you know, this content about Water Week or whatever it is. We didn't actually do it for that campaign, but you get the idea. You compare people who have never seen any of this content with people who have seen this content, and you see what's the difference between their attitudes or how they think of the brand. BuzzFeed does a lot of this with their sponsored content. And so that's the way to measure it. And it is very imprecise when you're at that level. You're just trying to basically take a stab at how many people saw this and are they thinking differently about this. The thing that is most useful, I've found, with those kinds of campaigns is actually pitting the content marketing campaign against another campaign. So say you have a billboard running about, you know, Pepsi cares about conservation or whatever at the same time. You would do basically a survey of people who live in the area and who are commuters who would probably be driving by that billboard and then do the same. I mean, it costs a lot of money and it's really involved, but basically ask them, have you seen the billboard? What do you think, you know, do you know about Pepsi's water conservation thing? What do you think? Do you think Pepsi cares about water conservation? You basically compare those results to the online content marketing results. And then you see, well, it looks like people that saw this stuff on Facebook and, you know, read the blog posts, they get it more than people who just drove by the billboard, that sort of thing. It's a lot easier when you're measuring how many people click to subscribe or to follow or to buy something. But in any case, making sure that you're comparing apples to apples, you're comparing the brand lift perception campaign with content to the brand lift perception campaign with other forms. Otherwise, if you compare it to, you know, Google ads, you're comparing two very different things with two very different kinds of intent and response types.
And one of the, we've been referring to the Pepsi example a lot, but you've also attracted a lot of other big brands for content leads, such as Marriott, Microsoft, and Walmart, just to name a few. And I'm wondering, how exactly do you get these big brands on board a service like Contently? Like, how do you get like these big brands that they have like so much revenue coming in that they could just choose whichever service they would want? So how do we create something that would get their attention?
Yeah, well, so initially, when content marketing started getting popular, it was a lot of these brands realized that they needed to do something with this, or they at least needed to experiment. So it became easy to get a lot of kind of pilot programs going with big brands. And how we did that as a company is we actually used content marketing ourselves. We built a blog, we had a quarterly magazine, well, we still do. But every day we were kind of the news of the industry. And we would critique content marketing campaigns, and we would offer advice, and we would share our strategies. And you know, we built up this big email list. So our own content marketing, we actually measure that whole funnel. You know, how many people are we reaching? How many of those people are, when we do these regular surveys, what do they think of us versus competitors? And then how many people actually subscribe to our email list, and how many of those people actually click on our stuff, and how many of those people, you know, want to talk business with us? So we track all of that ourselves. And we target our content. For a long time, we actually have been targeting our content at bigger enterprises that are, you know, our main customer type. And the years of doing content have started to pay off, where, you know, our conversion rates of how many leads from these big companies come in and how many of those actually close, they get better and better. But what I will say is, while initially a lot of big companies, you know, like Microsoft and whoever, knew that they had to try content marketing, how you get them to keep doing content marketing is by showing the results and the ROI. And I think that Marriott is actually a great example of this. They're one of my favorite customers. So they do a whole bunch of stuff. They, you know, they're a huge company. They're trying to raise awareness with some people. They're trying to get you to think, you know, of Marriott as high quality, but they're also trying to actually get people to book hotels. And so they have a couple of content marketing campaigns that are ongoing where they do this. They do a lot of social media stuff to keep, you know, Marriott top of mind for people. And they do these short films to get people to get excited about Marriott. You should actually look up Two Bellmen. They've done three of these. They're these awesome short films where these bellhops who do parkour are like always saving the day in the hotels. Like something goes wrong and these guys do like backflips to save the day. It's really fun. Anyway, that's all about getting you to think about Marriott. What they do with Contently is they actually produce these travel guides. So they came to us saying, you know, we want, when someone's thinking about traveling to New Orleans, we want them to book a Marriott hotel. But, you know, how are we going to do that? We think if we offer really in-depth guides of, you know, what to do in New Orleans and histories of the city and, you know, hidden stuff that you don't find on TripAdvisor or, you know, general tourist sites, we want to give people the most high quality kind of overview to how to have a great time in the city. And then if they do that, then hopefully they'll book a Marriott hotel. So they've built out tons and tons of cities. It's called Marriott Traveler. So using, sorry about the noise there. Using Contently, they've built out tons of cities. And basically what they do is every place that they write these, you know, these city guides for, at the bottom of every guide, it says, and here's hotels that are available. Here's, you know, prices, look up your hotel. And they actually, they call it putting heads in beds. They actually measure how many people per piece of content they put on their site and how they promote it, how many people actually book hotel rooms. And so this is further down the funnel. But based on that, they've justified vastly expanding their content marketing program because they can actually draw a direct line to revenue. And then, you know, people go and they stay in those hotels and then hopefully they stay again. And, you know, you get, they get their email address and they send them, you know, fun travel guides to other cities and those people consider going there. So it all kind of works out. But it, without that component of actually seeing some success, they would have seen content marketing as a nice experiment and then stopped after a year.
And it's really interesting how really big brands are adopting content marketing. And like, we know it's not just bloggers. We know it's not just podcasters, YouTubers. Like, we know that big brands are adopting it as well. But when you see it in action, when you hear about the examples, it really gives you more ideas for what you can do to grow your content brand. And part of that is having an effective strategy in place. You mentioned the strategy Marriott has for seeing their ROI and being able to get an ROI. So I'm wondering if you could share with us how we can go about creating effective content strategies.
Yeah. So, I mean, the easy plug would be that my second book that I co-wrote this book called The Storytelling Edge with our editor-in-chief at Contently. And there's a whole bunch of, if you just look up The Storytelling Edge, we have a free email course where you can actually get a lot of the insights about content strategy for free just by signing up for the email course. But that book, basically we dumped all of our content strategy secrets, starting with basically why stories and why content itself is powerful and what's the difference between content that works and content that doesn't. And then the second half of the book, we actually get into kind of hardcore, how do you build a content strategy? But I can share, you know, kind of the basic framework here, just for everyone who's listening. You want to, like most content strategies, I guess most people kind of start too far down the path. You know, they're putting the cart before the horse by saying, we want to target these people, so we're going to do infographics, or we're going to do YouTube videos, or we're going to do, you know, whatever. And they say, we have this much budget, so this is what we're going to do. You actually need to back way up, and you need to figure out what's the business objective. And you know, most people kind of have this in their head, but you need to very clearly define what's the business objective. And, you know, by that, that's kind of what I was talking about before. You know, are we trying to get leads or conversions? Are we trying to raise awareness for the brand? Are we trying to shift perception? What is that business objective? And if you have multiple of those, then you go through the content strategy exercise for each of those objectives. But then based on that objective, you got to say, well, then what are the metrics that are going to matter for this? You know, if the business objective is signups, you know, for your trial service or whatever it is, then you need to measure conversions, and you also need to measure whatever comes before that, you know, and maybe it's people who sign up for the trial before that, they tend to sign up for your emails, or they tend to, you know, visit you, you know, a page or whatever. You need to kind of back out the math of, you know, how many people you need to get for that to happen. And then you need to set an actual goal of how much do you want to move that metric. So you want to increase signups by, you know, 100% or 100 signups a month or whatever it is. And then you actually have to back out, well, how much exposure, how much traffic do we need to content? How many views to our, you know, social posts or whatever it ends up being? You need to have a pretty good idea of how much you need to do in order to meet your goals. And then after that, then you say, well, where this audience that we want to fulfill these goals, where are enough of them hanging out, you know, on the internet? Usually it's the internet, but where are enough of them hanging out that we can actually hit this goal? So what channels are they in? And, you know, often we jump straight to the channels and we'll say, oh, it's YouTube. And maybe after you've gotten this far in the analysis, you'll say, actually, YouTube is not going to be the move, but maybe you will. Maybe it ends up being the same thing, but at least you've gotten there deliberately. You know, so say you're trying to get signups and you're thinking YouTube and Pinterest and, you know, your company blog and your email list, that's where you're going to get people to eventually convert and sign up. And so then after that, then you say, well, what are the content formats that actually make sense for these? You know, what are the lengths of videos that are going to appeal to this audience, that sort of thing. And then after that, you talk, you know, topics. What's resonating with people now? What's going to be a blend between what we care about and what other people care about and what's trending? And that's where a little more of the art comes in. And then after that, you say, okay, you know, here's the plan. Here's the editorial calendar of the pieces of content we're going to produce, when we're going to put them out, how we're going to promote them. And now here's what we need in terms of staff to make that content and to edit it and all that and to push it. And then here's how much it should cost. So kind of doing all that. And then, you know, usually at that point you say, oh, wow, that's going to cost more than we think. So let's reduce our goal because, you know, we got to be realistic. We're not going to hit the goal if we don't have the, you know, the budget to make that realistic. So that's sort of the basic framework. And then really what happens is it's like the military analogy, you know, no, I'll get it wrong, but, you know, no battle plan survives the first shot. So basically, once you start, you're going to start measuring the results and the, you know, what you measure is going to be very different than what you planned. And so you adapt, you optimize what's working, you split test different things, and then you finally, you know, kind of ratchet down to the specific kinds of content and strategies that that actually yield the most results. And you always spend some time experimenting because you never know what's going to be a surprise. But that's the idea. So it is a pretty involved process. And what it takes is discipline and patience. But you also have to make sure not to neglect the creativity part. You know, the actually telling stories that are going to be interesting enough to get people's attention and keep people's attention, that often ends up being the hardest part. You know, kind of the science and the math part, adding up what you think is going to happen and then, you know, optimizing to get there. That's, you know, that takes time, but that's the kind of the repeatable thing. The thing that is harder is figuring out the kinds of content and getting the creative talent to, you know, to make content that people actually really love. I say that's the hardest part. Actually, the most difficult part is, the most frustrating part is when you have all of that down, actually getting it in front of people, getting people to care about it when you don't have an audience yet. That ends up being really hard if you don't have money to pay. But, you know, having great content and being able to get it out there so that it gets shared and people come find you, that is a huge part of making that happen.
And like in your answer, there's just so many parts of an effective content strategy. And sometimes it can feel overwhelming, but as you continue to put in the work, continue to create systems, all that does become a little easier over time. But one of the things I also want to tackle is in your experience with content creators who are just getting started or people who are on the road to success in these big brands also, as mentioned before, like Marriott, Microsoft, Walmart, Pepsi, and so many others. What do you believe are some of the common themes that hold content creators back from enjoying the big results they want to enjoy?
I think there's two things. So one of my favorite editors at Wired Magazine used to tell me that great writing, and I think this applies to anything with content, but to me it was writing because I'm a writer, said great writing is only one third writing. And the other two thirds are thinking and research. And so you'll only get good writing if all you do, you know, is write. So you'll only get good content if you just make content. You actually need to spend most of your time thinking, planning, and researching so that what you're actually making is going to resonate. It's going to pop. That's really hard and really important. It's where a lot of people go wrong. There's so much content on the internet now. And so if you're, you know, a creator or you're a business, you know, working with creators, trying to make something that matters, you have to be the tip of the iceberg that sticks up above the water. Otherwise, no one's going to see you because there's just a sea of content out there. And it's not just, you know, other stuff on the internet. It's also Stranger Things on Netflix is vying for your attention. And, you know, a million other things want your attention and are really good. So you need to create content that actually sticks out, that gets people's attention. We have this little diagram where we say that, you know, some percentage of your efforts should be dedicated to sort of the top of this pyramid, which is breakthrough content or blockbuster content, where you're putting a lot into, you know, thinking about and production value for content that is going to really pop. And then underneath that, you know, the bottom, you know, 2/3 of the pyramid are about cadence content, which is, you know, doing content that regularly keeps you top of mind, that, you know, reinforces what you're doing, but that's more sort of thoughtful and ongoing. And then at the bottom of the pyramid, you have essential content, which is like, if you don't have this content, you don't exist. So like your website, basically. So you need to dedicate some percentage of your efforts to the top of the pyramid, which is, you know, blockbuster content. That's the first one. And that requires a lot more thinking and research than we usually do. Usually, you know, creators say, oh, well, here's the topic and here's something I'm interested in. Or we'll do a top 10 list about this topic and here we go. And the problem is no one cares about that, or it's been done a lot, or it doesn't stick out enough for people to really see it. So you need to spend more time on that. And that's where data can help too. If you look at what's trending or what looks like it's going to trend, that's where you can often use data to kind of predict what could be hot later. Easier said than done. The other thing that foils content creators, and this goes for me as well, as a writer, someone who writes books, I've realized that, I just put out my third book, and half the battle is creating a good book. The other half the battle is getting people to pay attention or to care at all. And that goes for any kind of content, for content marketing, anything on any social media channel, or, you know, on your website or blog, or any video that you're doing on YouTube. Just putting out there is not enough. If you do the math, how many people know you and are going to see that, and how many of those people are going to share that, and how many people know them and are going to actually see that, and how many are going to share that? It's hard to make the viral equation work out if you don't seed it to enough people initially. And so even if the content is great, so this most recent book that I put out, Dream Teams, it's probably the thing I'm most proud of creating. Years of work, really important book to me, really fun read. And I think it's a great book and the reviews are great, but I've noticed that the more that I push marketing wise to promote it, the better it does. Just having it out there, people have no reason to pick up this book versus any other, you know, there's a million other books out there. And I've noticed that it's gotten harder between this book and my last book, and certainly for my first book. And it's the same thing whether you're talking about books or blog posts, that the effort that you put into getting attention for your content matters just as much, maybe, as sad as it is to say, maybe more, actually, at least initially. Once things pick up, you're fine. But if you know, the viral equation has to start with enough people that it doesn't die before, you know, it starts to spread.
And the marketing is definitely a very important piece. And in some cases, you do feel like you have to spend more time marketing than creating. Content creators usually prefer to do all the creation and just the marketing they figure out later. But you really do have to find more time for marketing. And that's just one of those things where you just make time in your day. You schedule it. It's easier to get done. But one of the things I also want to transition to is the fact that we all go through a lot of challenges throughout our journey, and with challenges at the forefront, I'm wondering if you could share with us one big challenge you faced in your journey and a powerful lesson you learned during that challenge.
Yeah, so I'm just getting comfortable talking about this in the because I finally wrote about it. The last chapter of Dream Teams, or the epilogue of Dream Teams, I actually talk about a personal challenge that I went through while I was going through all of this. So we were building Contently, things were taking off, we're a few years in, getting a lot of kind of public accolades, and I was getting invited to start speaking at some, you know, bigger and bigger conferences, clients are doing well, and I'd also just put out my first book, so this is about 5 years ago now, and I actually was going through a personal crisis at the same time, where sort of from the outside, it looks like, you know, everything's going great and like, wow, these guys and this guy, you know, this star is rising. But personally, I was going through this really hard personal crisis that, you know, one was a health scare where I actually didn't know. It was sort of a, yeah, I mean, well, I'll just say it. It was a cancer scare So I was thinking about, what does any of this matter? And, you know, what is life? You know, what do I want in my life? And then I was also going through another personal crisis. And basically, I was left being personally broke and unable to afford an apartment for 3 months, while on the outside, I had to put on this show of, you know, everything is great and we're so successful. And I just felt like such an imposter and so internally terrible. And I was really depressed. And I mean, you can read about it. The whole details are pretty crazy. But I went through this period where not only was I in bad shape, but I was too embarrassed to sort of get help. You know, I have a lot of good people around me, and I was too ashamed, embarrassed, or depressed to ask for help or to tell anyone about what was going on. I just figured, you know, I'll get through this and then it'll be fine and no one has to know. Meanwhile, I'm, you know, sleeping at the office because I have no place to stay, and you know, kind of sharing the generosity of friends, staying on couches and not really talking about what was going on with many people. And really what got me through it, and this is what I write, you know, I wrote this book about teamwork, and so the epilogue is about the teamwork that helped get me back on my feet, you know, and in my own small, you know, part of my own journey. And it really was a couple of people, but one was a mentor of mine who had been through some really hard stuff. He was a former crack addict and he had been in jail a few times, and he had turned his life around and become this, you know, amazing, famous journalist who liked to mentor, you know, young people like me. And he called me up and he figured out what was going on. And he would, he basically spent so much time, you know, calling me to check in. And instead of telling me it's going to be all right, telling me, you know what, this is going to suck. And it's okay to feel this way. And other people have been through it too. So just know that. And, you know, and we're here for you. And, you know, and then I had an assistant who was really helpful, who got me into meditation and to kind of get my mind more on things like yoga and exercise. And these people kind of gathered around me once they kind of figured out what was going on. And one, didn't judge me. Two, didn't, you know, tell other people. You know, they let me share my own story. But three, they were willing to push me to actually, you know, move forward and to face my challenges and to get through it. And I'm super grateful for that. And the lesson, I think, in terms of overcoming challenges is you don't have to do everything yourself. And don't be embarrassed. You know, often we go through things that are embarrassing, but you know, everyone goes through stuff, and certainly health problems are not embarrassing. I know a lot of people who have mental health, you know, challenges or disorders that they or their, you know, their family are afraid to talk about them because they're afraid of being judged. And that's so sad to me, because when we know most people are good and will reach out and will help and support, or will at least try. And that's what we need to get through really hard things like that. And whether it's, you know, for someone like me, it's kind of situational short-term depression in this really crappy situation, or it's someone who's dealing with something chronic, either way, having people around who care and being willing to share your story really matters. And you'll be amazed what people come out of the woodwork to help you. And so that's what I learned. And that's kind of why I decided to share that story at the end of, you know, this book that's, you know, primarily about you know, business and work and, you know, society. I decided to share the personal story about that because I think the more we can talk about our challenges, and the more people come to help us, but also the more other people realize they can talk about their challenges so that we can help them.
And I really like the idea of being vulnerable during a big life event and short-term depression. Because it, as you mentioned, it does get more people to say, okay, I could be a little vulnerable about this to get the support that I need, because getting support around any challenge is something that is really important, especially when it's a big one like a cancer scare and all the things that can take place and really affect the way you view life. So thank you for sharing with us that challenging, powerful lesson, which again, it was mentioned more in detail in Shane's book, Dream Teams, which will be in the show notes of this episode. But in addition to your book, Dream Teams, which I just mentioned, I'm wondering if you could share with us three books that you believe will have a positive impact on us.
Yeah, so I'm obsessed with this new book called The Creative Curve, which is by Alan Gannett. Just came out. It's my kind of nonfiction book because it marries pop science and, you know, real research with really fun stories about like the Beatles and the guy who runs Netflix's content algorithm and Taylor Swift, Lady Gaga, really interesting creative icons. But this book basically can help anyone who, whether you think you're creative or not, it can help you to be more creative. So I really love The Creative Curve. Two other books that I really like right now. Well, forever I've liked The Autobiography of Ben Franklin. I think that's such a great read. There's so many good life lessons in that, and also lessons on innovation and self-improvement. That one's really great. And I also think that it's important to read fiction. And I actually wrote about this as well in Dream Teams, that there's real science that shows that the more stories of people who are not like us that we take in, the more our brains develop intellectual humility, which is basically the capacity to respect other people's ways of living and doing things. Turns out that reading fictional books is a very good way to do this, which is cool. So basically people who read a lot of fiction tend to be more open-minded and sort of kind towards other people's viewpoints, which is cool. So the fiction book that I love the most is sort of the strangest book out there, but it's Kafka on the Shore by Haruki Murakami. And I keep reading that over and over again because it's so mind twisting. It's also about talking cats. I know that's a very weird pitch for a book, but I like reading books that really challenge me into going into intellectual territory or stories about people that I really am not like. And so books like Kafka on the Shore, anything by Murakami, anything by foreign authors, actually, I really like because you get a peek at different cultures that are unlike your own. You know, I grew up in a small town in Idaho. Now I live in New York, where there's a lot of different cultures sort of mixing, but it's, you know, mostly I'm surrounded by American culture. So reading fiction that takes place in other settings to me makes me really happy.
Shane, thank you for sharing with us those great book recommendations and the idea to read more fiction books as well. All those books will be in the show notes, markerberry.com/E216. We'll also throw in the link to my book, Content Marketing Secrets, within the show notes as well. And before we wrap up this episode, Shane, I've asked you several questions throughout our time together, but what do you believe is one question that we need to be asking ourselves more often?
I think it would be something along the lines of, what am I not what do I not consider changing my mind about? And could I consider a different way of thinking about it? I know that's a strange, I don't know exactly how to frame the question, but the idea that so much of what we think and our opinions and our points of view are fixed, but the way that we're going to move forward together, whether it's, you know, doing things better, you know, making breakthroughs in, you know, in our careers and in business, or it's actually being better citizens, members of community and family members. And often I think it's going to boil down to us having the humility to change our minds about things that are hard to change our minds about. So asking yourself, what have I not changed my mind? What am I very fixed in my point of view on? And what if I wasn't so fixed? What if I considered some other ways of looking at it, even if it's really hard? I think that's a useful exercise, a useful question. Even just considering it, hopefully will open us up to new possibilities about things that are maybe a little less hard to change our minds about, but we're still stubborn about. I would really like it if everyone in the world did that.
Shane, thank you for sharing with us that great question and all of your great insights throughout our time together. And again, Shane's book, Dream Teams, that will be in the show notes. So for anyone who wants to learn about basically a deeper dive into Shane's leadership work at Contently and just looking at some of the groundbreaking teams throughout history, see how they work, how it can make the world a little bit better because we're able to have better teams. Just check out his book, Dream Teams. Again, will be in the show notes. But Shane, I can't thank you enough for sharing all of your great insights with us today. It was such a pleasure to have you on Breakthrough Success.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for being an amazing host.
Thank you.
How does over 100 retweets per day sound to you? My free ebook, 27 Ways to Get More Retweets on Twitter, has you covered. I use the methods within this ebook to get over 10,000 retweets every single quarter. To learn